Welcome to Rate the Moon Episode 2, coming up, transfers, possibly more transfers, and even more on how to sift rumours through a sieve like the finest icing sugar. And I could walk 500 miles, don't worry, I wouldn't be singing about 500 miles, but either way, it wouldn't be close to covering the journeys Swindon have to make in the next month. We strap ourselves in for a manic midweek schedule. So here we are for Episode 2, having survived Episode 1. I think. Thank you for your kind of comments, feedback and criticisms, because I think almost without exception from the stuff I've seen, it has all been kind of thoughtful and constructive. I sense we've lived to fight another day. So,
yeah, we have. And constructive criticism on Twitter. Who'd have thought it? It's been a lovely response to the first episode. And we'll take a lot of the feedback on board, you know, the technical stuff, the content stuff, tone and style, and hopefully we can build it out as we get along over the coming few weeks and months and beyond, and look to make those incremental gains as we go.
Yes, indeed. I can hear Dave Brailsford patting himself on the back from a distance already at our approach here. I suppose the thing that I noticed, I may not have seen them all, is that lots of questions, or a significant number of the questions that people submitted, are kind of about how the media sausage is put together, which I feel is kind of of growing interest to people. And I do sense a kind of greater sophistication about it than when, I don't know, maybe John Watson was probing Brian Clough back in 1981.
I think that's right. I think that comes from the personalised experience that everybody has of the media nowadays. The advent of social media changed the game considerably in who was a publisher and what could be published. And I think everyone's now got an opinion on what the media is or what the media should be. And often the roles of independent journalists or citizen journalists have very different guardrails and guidelines than those of us who are in the industry from a more formalised setting and have been in the industry from a more formalised setting for a long time. And I think it's fine for people to have those differences of opinions, and I think it creates that curiosity as to what the media does and why it does it. And we should absolutely answer some of those questions. And I think some of the intricacies of covering Swindon Town from a media perspective have been truly very interesting over the time that I've been involved. So yeah, whatever questions people have about how the club is covered and how information is gained and shared and how you manage relationships and so on and so forth, I think that they're entirely valid. And I'm sure that when we get through the transfer window, at least we'll have an opportunity to go into them in a little bit more depth.
Yeah, I think so. I must admit, occasionally I've had people post on Twitter. I mean, you know, and I should say in a friendly way, I have seemed to escape the worst of it by and large. Saying, well, why didn't you ask that? And then I do look back and think, well, why didn't I ask that? So you never know. Sometimes, you know, if you're people outside the bubble have useful things to contribute to those of us who are sort of stuck inside it to some extent. Shall we stop navel gazing and give the people the transfer news they probably want?
Let's do it.
So let us begin by feasting like a ravenous and unwell wildebeest of January on the transfer news that is pretty frenetic around the county ground at the moment. And Sam, I don't think we can find a move that has gone with much more pace, it would seem, unfortunately for Swindon, than Finlay Munro, Aston Villa dash elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we always were aware that there would be interest, and I think, well, I came into the window relatively hopeful that they would make it through. They had to get to the 15th of January, which was the recall window, without there being serious offers on the table or prospective offers on the way. And unfortunately for Swindon, that didn't materialise, because over the weekend there were approaches from Middlesbrough and Bristol City, and I think there was another approach from overseas as well, which sort of hasn't really seen the light of day. I think for the player, for Villa, who weren't going to give him a contract to cash in a bit, it makes the most sense to be able to go and challenge himself at a higher level. And I think he's earned the right to do that. It is, of course, desperately disappointing for Swindon and Swindon fans because he's made such a significant contribution. But by the sounds of it, the move to Middlesbrough is all but done. And I know that Swindon fans will keep a very close eye on his progress up there. I don't think we're going to get the loan back that a lot of people will want from the way that it's being talked about at the moment, though things do change. It sounds like he's intended to be involved in first team affairs for the rest of the season. And given that Middlesbrough have spent a fee on him when he's only got 6 months left of his contract, specifically to get him in now rather than to face a bun fight as a free agent in the summer, you can understand them wanting to have a proper look at him over the coming few months. So, yeah, it moved fast. And, you know, Munro was even training. We saw him, didn't we? We saw him at the training ground deep in conversation on the phone in the middle of the afternoon yesterday. So that's how quickly these things can move in football. And I'm sure everybody at the club and in the wider fan base will only want to wish him well in his next gig.
Yes, I don't think even us slapping the phone out of the palm of his very hand would have...
We talked about it, didn't we?
would have kept him at Swindon. I have to say, having kind of thought about this, I'm not quite sure what the club could have done here, even if they were to, match whatever Middlesbrough and or Bristol City were prepared to throw in him as a fee, which would be very unlikely. It would feel almost reckless, I suspect, to compete with upper half of the Championship wages or to try and compete for Munro, no matter how much you would be confident that you would get a healthy kind of resale profit, as it were, on his development. So I think the cards have just kind of felt, I would say personally, as they had to do.
There's nothing they could have done. I mean, potentially at a push, they may have been able to find a transfer fee with installments that could have got close. But even that is something that would be beyond most clubs at this level. And it would require quite a lot of careful or creative accounting to get to it. But then you have to take into account what a suitable salary package would be. And as far as I'm aware, it would likely have required Swindon to double their top wage to be able to challenge with what he's roughly on currently at Aston Villa. I don't know what the offers will have been from Middlesbrough and Bristol City, but I'm sure they will have been close to that. So this is an instance where Swindon supporters need to realise our station, and I think most do. Once upon a time, the club was able to compete at that sort of level for players. And maybe once upon of the future, they'll be able to again. But right now, it is a case, unfortunately, of making the most of the riches that we get to borrow rather than have for ourselves.
The only kind of immediate consolation I can think of is I've really seen Ian Holloway with quite such a devilish grin as when the discussion of replacements was kicking around in the pre-Luton news conference. So, this is a player who is not going to be easy to replace in terms of, you know, quality. You just look at the numbers, a couple of goals, the leading assist maker, and surely the leading slide tackler, if such stats were kept. Yet he was unexpectedly cheerful. I wouldn't say cheerful, but unexpectedly bullish about the whole thing.
Yeah, they definitely have a target list in place. As far as I'm aware, there isn't actually one done, but I would be surprised if it took a great deal of time for them to come to an arrangement with a similar player. I expect it to be a loan again. I expect it to be a similar profile, but that's not necessarily guaranteed. And if they could find a way of making that loan a permanent deal, then I think they would prefer to have a player of their own rather than to borrow. But I do expect it to be a very sort of similar profile. You can never guarantee whether they'll be able to contribute to the level that Munro contributed, but I expect them to be that younger side, second loan maybe, and looking to create a real groove for themselves in EFL football. So, it'll be interesting to see how quickly they get this person in, and there'll be several that are on a list depending on their availability at their current clubs. And I would expect that person will be in the next 10 days, 2 weeks?
Well, I guess Vinnie Munro parts with us all having visions of swinging in that free kick against Gillingham for Ryan Tavazzoli to head in and goals against Tranmere and much more. Adios and bon voyage. I think we all kind of got a good sense, even if there wasn't the definitive kind of sort of whispers that Prince Wellaya Bacheman and Adam Murphy were going back, and it has come to pass in both cases.
Yeah, and it's sensible for both the players and for the clubs. In all cases, I think it makes sense. Bacheman's one was a mutual decision. Evidently, there was not the route to first team football that they had hoped for in the start. I think there was a clause within that Southampton would have had the chance to recall if he hadn't played 50% of. If you haven't started 50% of minutes, and obviously never came close to that, but this wasn't a recall or return; it was a mutual arrangement, and it's right for him. He just didn't quite fit in. He started well, but didn't find the role, particularly after Drinan starts scoring so frequently, to be that centre forward, that number nine, and. His ability on the ball is obviously there, but it never came to pass that he could quite take on a man like Holloway would want. And hence we've seen the arrival of Michael Olakigbe. And hopefully he can go out and get another loan and try and find the minutes that he was not going to find in Swindon. And for Murphy, I think that's probably more of a tinge with regret that he wasn't available for enough time to see what he could do. Holloway was certainly very much gushing in praise for him when we last spoke to him last week about his contributions and what he could do in the future, but only 77 minutes of league football was never going to be enough to encourage him to keep that spot for the second half of the season. And when you've got a prospect like Aidan Borland available to you and available immediately, whereas Murphy is likely to not play again till the end of the month, I think that it was a very sensible decision. So Holloway did seem to be letting him go with a little regret, but from Swindon Town's perspective, I think there was only one decision there.
Yeah, a victim of circumstance, perhaps more than fundamental ability. Though, how much of it we can really judge on 77 minutes of league football and a little bit of EFL Trophy fun and games. Who can say? But yeah, certainly the manager seemed a little bit wistful that it hadn't worked out as perhaps he liked him. I think they only interviewed him once, but his attitude was kind of pretty, or felt in the right space. Anyway, that will be a pleasure for Bristol City reserves and maybe someone else to find out a little bit more. So there's the kind of outgoings, or the obvious outgoings. Where do we stand on incomings? I know we were knocking around the name Fletcher Holman in episode one.
Yeah, that seems to have stalled. Not clear to me at the moment on what part it stalled, but he was one that was in discussions and it looked to be progressing nicely a week or so ago, but it is no longer progressing nicely anymore. So I would put that as an outside shot of coming through this transfer window. There is likely to be one this week, which the name is already out there, which is Ben Middlemass from Sunderland. That's one that they've been talking to for a little while. I believe a deal has been agreed. I mean, by the time this gets published on Tuesday, it may well have already been announced, but it may stretch a little bit longer than that until we get to hear formally. He's a tricky midfielder. Good with ball at feet, probably more in the Kilkenny mode out of everyone that is on the Town squad at the moment. So one for the future, and Holloway's obviously had some success in signing players out of Premier League academies this year. So whilst he might not be one immediately involved from a starting perspective, hopefully we can trust that Holloway's eye for a player can continue after Joe Snowden and Filozofi Mbete.
I was almost going to say maybe we have to kind of be a little bit patient, just because Snowden in particular and Mbete to a considerable extent have done so well with that transition immediately. I'm not sure that's always going to happen for everyone, but midfield bodies are certainly are certainly welcome of all kinds, shapes and varieties, I think.
He's another one of these players that could tie defence and attack together quite quickly. I think Aidan Borland said in his first press conference that he was that sort of player too. I think Borland is probably a bit more deeper lying than Middlemass. And obviously Middlemass will be Swindon's player on a permanent deal rather than being on loan. So for Swindon's sake, this is the one that hopefully sticks and can make an impact relatively quickly. But he's certainly very influential at Premier 2 level, the youth development level that Sunderland's Academy play at their under 21s. Another instance, though, of what's the jump up like into senior men's football? Can he deal with it physically? Can he deal with it mentally? And how quickly will he settle in? But as we've seen with Snowden, as we've seen with Mbete, these players can do it, and hopefully this will be another instance.
Yeah, and I suppose thinking about it, neither Snowden nor Mbete had had a kind of senior loan of any great note before coming to Swindon. I know he's had a bit at South Shields, but that's about it. So they very much are kind of thrusting him in a little bit untried. But as we've pointed out, that doesn't necessarily mean that he can't produce quickly.
No, it doesn't mean that he can't produce. It also mean that he might not be able to produce. It is a bit of a punt, as all of these would be punts coming out of Premier League academies. But we have to trust in this instance that Holloway's eye for a player is still working, and it does seem to be. So let's give the guy a chance, see how he fits in, see how he plays. He has been very well regarded at youth level up there, and it's just a case of stepping into men's football.
Yeah, I may have a tangent to go on here, but I wonder what this means for Danny Gonzalez, George Alston, players of that ilk, that there is potentially another young midfielder coming in to the system, because one of the things you probably want your recruitment to do in the long term, and this gives me a great excuse to go off on a slight rant here, so bear with me, is you don't know if you think you've got real prospects coming up, you don't want to kind of block off their path to the first team. So the classic example of how not to do this felt like Jeff King last year, who Jeff King, nice man, very nice man, league footballer, CV possibly suggests not, eye test possibly suggests not, signed anyway. When you have one of your brightest players from your FA Youth Cup run who's already had a little bit of first team action in the same position. So not only do you possibly dilute your present if you get the wrong player in the wrong position, you also mess around with your future a bit. And the fact that Jeff King disappeared fairly quickly, you know, perhaps shows some of the signs of the recruitment issues in the last iteration. But there we are. I can get off my pedestal.
I mean, I can see the point. I think I would also add here that he needs midfield bodies, as you've said already here. And the more players that are his own rather than having to borrow gives him more flexibility in the market to fill in gaps later on, either in this window or in the summer. So I think having those options are good, and having youthful legs in those departments are good. Obviously, Kilkenny is in that middle bracket when it comes to experience and age. But otherwise, with Nichols and Clark, that I think you need something else available to you. And he doesn't have a lot of central midfield options on sort of permanent deals. So, yeah, it could be said that it would prove to be a blocker for other players. I think Alston's a bit more of a wider player, and he evidently likes what Danny Gonzalez is doing Holloway at the moment. So I wouldn't be too worried that I couldn't prove myself to this manager if I was a young player. He definitely seems to give you the chance. Obviously, if you abuse that chance, then you're probably less likely to get an invite again, but I think you'll probably get more of a chance to prove yourself in the first instance. So door's definitely not shut on these players, and certainly not Danny Gonzalez, who is very highly rated.
Yeah, we will see how he does. Probably last word on this. We're seeing Crawley sign everyone Scott Lindsay knows. We're seeing MK Dons throw money around. Neither of these factors is particularly surprising. But does it feel like, or is our sense that kind of academy prospect who hasn't quite made it at first team level is the sort of area they're looking at the moment. There's not going to be a sudden big outlay on. I almost dread quoting this name just to give it some more oxygen. But Paul Mullen, for example.
I've been telling people, and I continue to tell people on social media, etc., that I'd give that a wide berth, but you never know, I guess. I wouldn't understand it as a signing from a footballing perspective. He's got his main marquee experience striker, which they shifted the bank around for to get in the summer. He's got the top scorer in the division, who's in the form of his life, and they've just brought in an additional winger to help play alongside him. He's got a 30-odd-year-old with a lot of experience in the Football League in Bill Bowden available to him. And Jake Tabor around to back up. If you bring a senior player in, particularly in a role where they would expect to be starting more often than not, into a successful team that's got a formula that has been working, is that going to have a net benefit? I think only if you have a player that is ready to come in and make such a significant impact that it's impossible not to bring them in. I don't see, given his recent form and where he is in his career, etc., that is necessarily the case with Paul Mullen. Though evidently he's good enough and probably too good still for League Two. But would that benefit the group as a whole? Holloway's big on what benefits the group as a whole and big on characters behind the scenes. He's got a lot of senior players in place. I don't see why that sort of profile would be the sort of player that he would go for. What I should add in here as a caveat is that the chairman has form for making bold signings in the January window and in other windows late on to make a statement. I don't think he needs to do it in this window. And if I were him, I'd save my money. But he's got form. So would he be looking to do that? I've got no information that he is necessarily. It's just speculating as to his past track record. But I don't see the benefit of throwing cash in that situation when you've got a proven striker alongside one of the most informed players in the league. And you've got a supporting cast that will happily play the role of the supporting cast. I don't think there's a need to do it. And it would, in my opinion, be a little bit foolhardy to do so.
Yeah, it is hard to quite see the logic when there is a lot of experience up there. I'm also prone to saying last one and then adding another, of course, because who doesn't like sneaking in an extra question? I thought it was quite interesting that Ian Holloway, unprompted in the press conference, mentioned Ricardo Rees as someone they'd at least looked at. The quick CV is banging in a lot of goals for Merthyr in National League North, went to Forest Green in the end, I think. Other league clubs were looking at him and not able to match whatever Dale Vince has got tucked away in his back pocket. But again, going back to that sort of blocking thing, you take another striker from non-league, and what does that do to the minutes you give Jake Tabor and so on and so forth? But it was nice to hear a name come out.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? He won't discuss the ones that he's actively been in conversations with, but we'll talk about the ones where it's actually finished and you can no longer have a chance of signing them, which is fine. It's fair enough. I think it shows that they are looking in all sorts of directions for the sorts of players that they want. And they would happily take from a Premier League academy. They'd happily take from non-league. And in the right instance, they would invest in a senior professional. Again, this comes back to a piece that I wrote last week. Some people agreed with it, some people didn't, about the way in which the recruitment has changed and evolved over the last 2 or 3 years, and particularly under Holloway. And there does seem purpose and structure and intent to what's going on, and that's partly caused by the environment, which has been influenced by Holloway, and a lot less hands-on stuff from above. But it is also deserving of praise because there does seem to be stability in that, and without stability in that area, you end up with some monstrous transfer windows that don't make sense or make you over-reliant on other people's players, or bring you in players to play in systems that you end up not playing, or playing in systems that they can't play in. I think one thing that has substantially changed over the last two transfer windows has been, the last three transfer windows has been the focus and the intelligence in forward planning, which for whatever reason was made not particularly easy prior to Holloway's arrival.
Sometimes the best thing a chairman can do is nothing at all, if that's to try and get... I feel like that should be some musical lyrics somewhere, but it's not quite. And for more, of course, in this marathon transfer section, because I've got a bit between the teeth now, especially with Tom Wilson-Brown and co getting back into fitness, can Ryan Delaney get out the exit door, which it feels would be a wise move for him, I think.
Yes, and I think the answer will be yes this window. I think that there is an offer that is good enough on the table from another League Two club. And at this stage, as we record, I'd expect him to be able to go off and play some minutes elsewhere for the rest of the season and hopefully build a career beyond that. And I think there's no ill will towards him. He's just not fitted into Holloway's plans, and it's important for him and his family and his future career that he gets out and finds another club. So hopefully that offer is satisfactory enough and it will be a done deal this month.
Yeah, I think even though it's been made sort of very clear to him he's not been part of the squad, I don't get any real indication that there's anything other than a perfectly professional approach by him. So we'd wish him well. And like I say, he needs to get on his way to get that career going. So one of the things we did touch in on episode one was the kind of waiting of transfer rumours. How credible do you think they are? How believable should they be? How ridiculous are they? How much are you sucking in? Because there's something about seeing a nice avatar in a tie with a very professional-looking Twitter profile that makes us all want to believe, especially when it indicates a rather good signing. And I feel this point has been exercising, that would be overdramatic, but somewhat on your mind.
It's always on my mind at transfer window time. Transfer window time, for those of us who are on this side of the industry, is among the most frustrating periods of the year. I mean, this one isn't too bad because it's only a month. The summer one can be absolutely relentless. I think you get an immediate gut instinct when you're doing it day in, day out, of what rumour feels like absolute nonsense and what feels like it's come from a place where there is more credibility. And the trouble being is that not everyone can discern between the two. So you often get asked the question, regardless of the name, regardless of the scenario, regardless of the source. And that can become incredibly frustrating because you want to spend your time actually looking for a real story rather than having to refute absolute crap. And unfortunately, the football industry is very, very good at creating crap. And over the course of these windows, we have to deal with that. I think what would be useful for everybody is an understanding of what a good source looks like and where they can discern between engagement farming on social media and people who have inside information and might be reporting something that actually has a tangible impact on the club that they support. Unfortunately, I think increasingly as a society, we get lost within social media and like to think that anything that we see is true. We are losing the ability to critically assess where this information is coming from. I mean, a lot of this is me being miserable and grumpy and shaking off the after effects of a very long winter cold, but...
Evidently.
Yeah, I'm feeling like my voice is getting lower and lower with every question that you ask. But I think that there's a serious point to it too, Andrew, because we have to understand what a good source looks like or what a verifiable source looks like. And it doesn't take that much critical thinking to get to that point. You can have a look at someone's background, their published work, their profile. You can have a look at their previous reporting. You can compare what they've said against what's happened in reality. And and establish whether they have an in with a club, whether they've got attachments to certain players. We don't have to loosely accept everything that we see on social media. And when we do, it makes it a lot harder to create a stream of solid information, because you're constantly having to go out and show that other information is not right. So, yeah, this month is frustrating, just like the summer is. I think, you know, part of it is the transfer industry has created itself its own sort of microclimate, and everybody wants to be the next Fabrizio Romano or David Ornstein. But those are freaks of nature, and their contact books are just 0.1%, 0.01% level. Most often you'll get to know the people who are credibly breaking transfer news because they have been doing it for a while, and they have been doing it under their actual names. And they have been doing it by taking responsibility for when they get things wrong. And more often than not, lower down the leagues, that will come from your local media. They'll have sources who will also be on social media, but rarely will those sources want to post anything. But they'll be happy to share with a trusted individual, because you can treat information responsibly. And the treatment of information responsibly is another area that we've become increasingly bad at as a society over the past few years. I could go on forever, Andrew, unless you stick your foot in and trip me up here, because it ires me.
Do I need to dive in with some form of rugby tackle here, possibly? I've been slightly problematic and referencing what we've already been talking about. For example, the Ben Middlemass story emerged kind of, one, from sort of Football Insider, who do, I think, have some credibility in terms of getting past things right and who runs it, and two, it was also in the Sunderland paper, and you kind of look at those two and think, the probability is that someone somewhere in Sunderland has been happy to talk about this, or that's how I would look at it. Whereas the Paul Mullen thing, I've not seen anyone actually kind of link it. It just seems to almost have been floating around because he's a former Swindon player and he's available to some extent. So that feels like a fairly easy swing of the pendulum as to what you can identify as plausible or mysterious.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable assessment. If you've got a traditional media outlet and a new media outlet both reporting the same story, Peter O'Rourke is a very connected journalist. He's primarily connected to agents and has a lot of knowledge about these sorts of things. I mean, in this particular instance, I was aware of this move a little bit before, but not in a way in which I felt comfortable reporting it. And that's another part of this, is verifying stories. A journalist will verify and try and fact check as much as possible, rather than regurgitate information they've heard via Chinese whispers.
I suppose the counter argument to that is sometimes someone who's had a haircut next to Billy Bowden, for example, that's a completely random name I've pulled out of the air, and here's something might actually be right. I guess that's where it gets more complicated.
And that's absolutely true. And the funny thing is that this has always happened, but previously that might have been hidden away on a chat board, or they might even have got in direct touch with the local paper, which is something that used to happen on a regular basis, or the local paper would be able to allow their writers to get out and about and find out this stuff because they would have conversations with supporters all the time. So it is true that information can appear. It's more the verifying of it.
Yes.
That it's very unlikely that you're going to find someone whose job it is to report just spurting out the first thing they hear immediately after hearing it. They're going to go away and do a little bit of work to establish whether what they've heard is in any way accurate. And that's the difference between gossip and journalism. Whilst we like to deal in gossip in the transfer industry, I think the word gossip, you know, the BBC has run a gossip column, for example, for many years. It's not typical gossip. A lot of that work has been at least semi-sourced. Whereas it's a lot easier for nothingness to spread online because people don't have the same guardrails that people who are paid, people who are trained by the industry have. As you say, there are negatives to this in that sometimes there are stories which journalists are overly cautious with, or journalists have relationships that they need to maintain. So in order to balance out one story, another one might be kept under wraps. Nothing particularly major would ever be this, but for minor stories that can happen, a sort of exchange of information. But largely you will find that the work of journalists who have been in the industry, trained by the industry, paid by the industry, has at least a little bit more rigor to it. People will have different opinions as to whether that is a good thing or a bad thing. When it comes to transfer rumors, I think we can just treat everything that's said across social media as entertainment, and try and then see for the individual sources themselves as to whether or not we should put any authority on it.
Yes, and I look forward to Paul Mullen signing on Thursday, but I can't. But I can't. I can't see it happening for what it's worth. So finally, we thought we'd take some kind of look at Swindon's schedule here, because in concise terms, it is nuts. It is basically two games a week until, I think, Valentine's Day, and then if Swindon can win a cup tie or two, it might get even more mad. I can tell you in the next month, not even in the next 6 weeks, there is 1,470 miles worth of round trips coming up to Salford, Harrogate, and all the rest. So that schedule is looking pretty packed. The squad is hopefully looking resilient, but I guess you wonder how much it is just going to drain people to some extent.
Yeah, I think Holloway's got his work cut out in deciding how he wants to rotate this group over the next period. Obviously, they've had what will equate to a 12-day break between games by the time they get to Luton. But that still only comes after a pretty manic December as well. So it's not easy to then go into bang, 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 bang. And he'll need to rotate, and fans will need to bear with him as he rotates. Benefits, there are players coming in who are likely to be able to play more minutes than those who have gone out. So the combined minutes of Eheb Achiman and Murphy and Delaney, which must have only maybe got to five and a half hours of league football, are going to swap with players who are very likely to play more. So that allows him to rotate a little bit more and to have more confidence in his squad. But it's still an awful lot of fixtures in a short period of time. And particularly the next five could really make or break the season. There's an opportunity, if they go on a patch of form over these next five matches, to make a real statement and have huge momentum heading into a series of league games against what we can generously describe as average to lowly teams in League Two. So if they can find in themselves maybe 5 or 6 points out of nine and a couple of progressions in the FA Cup and the EFL Trophy, I think that would represent something quite substantial going into the second half of this period. But it is a lot, and I'm not particularly envious of the amount of driving that you're going to be doing over the coming weeks.
No. You know, sympathy for football journalists should always be put on the played on the smallest of violins. But I think that kind of looking at that and gulping a bit does indicate that there's going to be a lot of sort of, you know, kind of hour stuck on a coach. And I think it's perhaps just those hours travelling back as well. And, you know, getting back from Harrogate and Salford at, you know, ungodly o'clock. I don't know really what that does in terms of, you know, whether them sort of having those kind of activation days, whatever they're called, or just kind of coming into training and warming down after all that. So how you manage everyone, I think for that is quite difficult. And I make it 432 combined minutes from Eheb Achiman, Murphy and Delaney. So I would think Olakigbe and Delaney alone should get past that pretty, pretty fast.
Yeah, it's a lot of travelling. And travelling by coach is never the most comfortable experience, even in their slightly more luxurious coaches. I think that, yeah, it's these five games coming up, Andrew. I think this is absolutely huge. And playing three of the promotion contenders, and then that FA Cup game and the game on Tuesday at Luton, and how they respond to that after this break is going to be really interesting, because we all know what happened after the last unscheduled break in this season.
Yeah, and it is, of course, different, of course, because, you know, if you know you've got a break coming up, you can actually kind of put in downtime, or maybe if you're of Ian Holloway's less pleased mind, you can put in extra running time for them all. But they've still gone through part of the kind of prepare for the game, travel up to the game to some extent. You know, they got at least halfway up to Harrogate and so on, come back. So there's not that kind of full sort of rest and recovery from this extended period. But yeah, it's impossible not to see your eyes attracted to you, as you say, that kind of Bromley, Salford and Notts County treble bill coming up.
Well, they haven't been off on holiday, which obviously they did when that Notts County game got postponed earlier in the season. Quite rightly, I think, Holloway gave his players 4 days off. They went all over the place. Saw on Instagram all around the world, which is fine. It's understandable. You don't get a lot of downtime between, well, basically all season, all year as a footballer. You get a very limited amount of downtime. So that made sense. But I think that it possibly interrupted their mental rhythm, even if we're not talking about their footballing rhythm. So having been in, continued training, and had some more time to practically apply themselves for the games coming up, it may end up as a benefit, and they're by far from the only team to have experienced this as well. So that most of the league is on a pretty equal footing with it. But that's not to say that some teams will deal better with it and some teams will deal worse. I would be very surprised if Holloway lets them have the same effect as it did the last time. I think he will have pretty clearly identified with them what happened before, and well, I wouldn't want to be in the dressing room if it happens again.
No, fool me once and all that, I suppose. Not that the players kind of fooled him, if you know what I mean, but more kind of don't make the same mistake twice, I think is what I'm trying to say in a not very erudite and roundabout way. But yeah, lots of travel to come, lots of fixtures to come, lots of transfer stuff to come as well, and you can read about it on the Moonraker and enjoy Sam's dotting off special features around, like on Swindon's more successful approach, it seems, thus far to bringing players in and out.